I'm Debbie Dashinger. Welcome to Dare to Dream. Be inspired to live big and bold and take action to turn your dreams into your reality. Go beyond obstacles and limits of your thinking. Accelerate results to catapult yourself to success. I'm a visibility expert who gives media makeovers to clients, booking them on media interviews and turning their books into international bestsellers with guaranteed results. Join me at DebbieDashinger.com. Dare to do great things. Dare to shine. It's all about you becoming a visionary and leading the pack. Welcome to your daring new life.
Welcome to part two. I'm Debbie Dashinger. This is the Dare to Dream podcast. I have been on air and on podcasts for over 13 years. Thank you for making the show what it is today. And thank you always for subscribing, letting people know about the show, leaving us reviews. And I do read all your comments. I really appreciate it. My guest, this is a part two series. I have back Ruben Langdon. We've already been having some magnificent conversation. He's a Los Angeles, Tokyo-based actor, filmmaker, truth seeker, and he's had quite an illustrious career. Currently, Ruben is the host of Gaia TV Network show Interview with Extra Dimensionals. You can find out more about him at rubenlangdon.com. And Ruben, I welcome you back to the show. It's so great to still be with you.
Yes. Let's continue the conversation. It's been fun.
Yeah, I feel like we're just getting started. You brought up things that I'm very excited to talk about. So I want to do some deep diving with you, if you're comfortable, to talk about the world of ayahuasca and medicine in general. Mm-hmm. So, okay, my friend, if you would, you've already said you've done it, but let's talk about, how did grandmother find you? How did she tap, tap, tap? And what got you interested?
Well, I think mostly it's, I think we do the finding in a sense. I guess it's a two-way pump. For me, I had on my journey as far as the extraterrestrial work, I'm discovering that there's more to reality than what we've been dished up, so to say, in our society and in media. And all this was sort of happening to me while I was working on the film Avatar. I was, my whole world paradigm was shifting for a few reasons. One, I was, my job was to be a Navi, to be a indigenous alien from another world with different belief systems and ideas than sort of the military visitors that were mining this ore for power. And I was there as a Navi to help. So simultaneously, I was there playing a Navi to help Jake Sully go through his journey to understand who the Navi were. I was also the main double for Jake Sully. So I was playing the guy learning what this reality was. So I was having to be a teacher and a student in the same movie and constantly flipping roles daily, you know, okay, who am I today? You know, and you're wearing a motion capture suit. So it's just a sticker that says today I'm Navi or today I'm Stunt Jake. And that's what determined which role I was going to wear that day. And some days I'd be both. So I was constantly flipping back and forth. And as the Navi, we had to become indigenous teachers, because that's the role we're playing. So in order to inhabit that role, and you know, as an actress, you do as much homework as you can on the role you're playing, and you try to find out as much as you can. And Cameron was very adamant about us learning as much as we could about indigenous cultures, because the Navi were modeled after indigenous cultures. And I first found out about this sacred ceremony called ayahuasca while actually on the set of Avatar. there was a scene that was cut. You can go online, and I think if you do a search, you can find this scene that was rendered out in without the beautiful graphics, but in a really low res graphics, where Jake has to take a psychedelic worm and he goes on a journey. And I remember I was part of the group capturing the journey, being in the audience, so to say, to hold space for Jake as he went on this journey. And this was part of his initiation to become a Navi. So Cameron came on set and explained, okay, here's what we're doing. This is based off this indigenous from South America. They do this in the Amazon. It's called ayahuasca. It's a psychedelic tea that they pass around. It's in a circle and they do this thing. And I was like, okay, that's fascinating. That's interesting. And that's the first time I heard about it. So I played the Navi and I did that. And then I saw Jake go through his journey. So that sparked my curiosity. Okay, is this is based on something real. This exists in our reality, in our society somewhere out there, right? So I started doing some more research and found out a fellow stuntman of mine named Trampas had been quite vocal of his ayahuasca experiences and was recommending other people in the industry, stunt industry, to go and try it. So I was like, well, this guy knows something. Let me go talk to him. This was back in like 2009, 10. The movie had already come out and I knew someday I was going to do it. And I was like, I was still in nerd mode. So I had done zero. I hadn't smoked pot. I'd barely been drunk. I'd never done any psychedelic type drugs in my life. So this was sort of a big deal for me because for me being a stuntman and all about focus, it was all about control. And losing control over my body or even my mind was something that actually didn't interest me at all. But I wanted to explore this reality because the more I researched psychedelics, the more I researched particularly ayahuasca, I realized that it's not about losing your mind or going, you know, crazy or whatever, or getting high in a sense that, that we had been sort of told through society that that's what drugs are used for. You know, you're just going to get high. So I took did more research, interviewed him, talked, discussed, and then eventually, I had signed up to go down to the Sacred Valley in PSAC in Peru to go and experience this ayahuasca experience. Lo and behold, this was right after I had my run-ins with government and other things and citizen hearing, and I lost my business and I was sort of following what breadcrumbs I could to survive. And I ended up in Atlanta, Georgia. And through some friends and synchronicities, even though I had signed up to go to PSAC, I didn't have the funds to do it. At that same time, it would have been the same time, I got a call from a friend saying, hey, I have some friends doing ceremony. Would you be interested in joining? It's a sort of an underground ceremony thing. And I said, yes, actually, it's funny you called. I was wanting to have this experience at this time and I just couldn't afford it financially. And grandmother brought it to my door. So that's how that happened. And I really don't want to go into more detail because I don't want, you know, this is still Schedule One substance, 100%. And we have to honor those who are doing this work underground and in private. Yeah. But essentially, it is, that's what it is. This is amazing work. And the fact that the FDA continues to classify DMT, mescaline, psilocybin, and even THC as a Schedule One substance, that in itself is criminal. And a big hats off to Oregon for decriminalizing these substances and yes. being the way showers for the rest of the United States moving forward. So, and I'm sure you have many guests. It sounded like your upcoming guest is already well in this world of the powers of these medicines and these experiences when used correctly. Now, I do believe that they can be misused, and they are very powerful tools that need supervision and people who are responsible and have had the training and experiences to hold the space that needs to be held when these sacred plant medicines are ingested.
I'm so with you. I get invited. Mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with invitations, mm-hmm. but I have a problem with barometer. And I just measure, you know, I always do my research. Mm-hmm. Is this person a shaman? How long? I mean, I want to know way details. Where was this brewed? Who brewed it? What is the situation? Or what kind of helpers do we have? What is the location?
Yeah.
I mean, it's very important. This is my consciousness. Mm-hmm. So I know when I'm going into ceremony, I want that time, that money, that commitment, that experience to count. Mm-hmm. And I am very protective of myself. So, you know, no greater words were spoken than what you just said. So, you know, you mentioned DMT, that's the psychoactive component of ayahuasca.
Awesome. Correct.
So where, and you mentioned going to Peru, where else in the world, Ruben, have you done medicine? What countries?
I've only done it in the United States.
Hmm.
Not even in Peru.
Oh, so this friend called you. Mm-hmm. You have this opportunity, but you don't have the funds. And you say, mm-hmm. funny you should call.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny how grandmother orchestrated that one.
That's right.
Or my higher self or whatever other, the ETs or the other energies orchestrated that synchronicity for that to happen at that time. Because it had something I had been planning for 2 years. It was to go down to the jungle, and I signed up for the thing. And but because of what I was going through financially, all my funds got stripped away. So I couldn't afford the trip and I had to cancel it. And yeah, through synchronicities at that time, I'd sort of forgotten about it because I, you know, so much had happened, with the finances and stuff that it was just like, so off my radar. It was like, that's not going to happen anytime soon. And then it happened. So when you seek it, when you set your mind to, that you want to spend time with grandmother and you're like there and you're not like scared or afraid or maybe or whatever, it will come at the exact right time when you need it.
I think you can be afraid. I have no idea.
Afraid is one thing, but afraid of, there's fear of change in a good way, and then there's just fear in the sense that of the unknown, because it's unknown, and there's other, you know, other, there's, I guess there's different levels and different types of fear. So,
yeah. You know, I mean, I'm an anomaly. I don't even understand myself, but I accept myself, but I'm really fear-based about a lot of things, but I'm also this huge risk taker. Go figure. Last time I drank, it really came up for me, you know, cause we're in the middle of this really weird situation. So I was actually doing a socially distancing ceremony. So, and I was scared, like a lot of fear came up, and it was about my time to get up and grab the cup. And I asked myself the question that makes sense to me in my world, in which I really appreciate. It's sort of like the Debbie question. You're at a crossroads. What are you going to do? Cause I literally know if I keep going down this path with the fear that is increasingly becoming more real and voracious, I know I'll go head first into panic.
Yeah.
Or you could jump.
Yep.
I mean, it's like, seems crazy to pose that to yourself, but it's like, literally, I got myself here. There's a reason. And I'll always go, yeah, okay, we're going to jump.
Well, that's the analogy I use for society right now in our political and social, economical, you know, reality that we find ourselves in right now, is we basically there for the people who are still in it. And I don't consider you and I still in it per se, because we're kind of doing our own thing, and we're bypassing that reality. But there are many people who are stuck in that reality, in the polarized reality, I say, in the political polarity, the economic polarity, the just plain old polarity, that are so full of fear and rage. And I think one feeds the other. More the fear feeds the rage than anything else. And this idea of hopelessness and this not knowing the future, this uncertainty, and this eventually, when you're in that, there's basically, like you said, there's two choices you can choose. You can continue to go down that path, and we know where it leads. It leads to more of the same, and until ultimately you just self-destruct. That's because you cannot. It's not a non-sustainable emotion, a non-sustainable energy to continue down this path. Or you can unplug from that reality and do something completely different. And that's the crossroads humanity is on this global scale right now, is we all individually can unplug from this nonsense of polarity or continue down that reality, and we know where it leads.
Yeah. Yeah. For people who don't know, I mean, this is a pretty prevalent conversation and subject these days, but there are still people who haven't known or may have heard or may be scared. So I'll just give you like a little bit of background before we go on. So ayahuasca is sometimes known as the tea or the vine or la purga. And it is brewed. It's literally plant material that's brewed. It's the leaves of a shrub. It's along with a stalks of a vine. And A-Y-A means soul or ancestors, and huasca means vine or rope. So when you put it together, it's basically vine of the soul. Pretty cool. This is ancient stuff. We are just in this modern world-ish coming into this. It's becoming more prevalent. I think, I believe the ancestors said there would come a time when it would go out into the world, much less held on to by the tribes and more into the world. So traditionally, what we're talking about is that there is a shaman, there's a curandero is how you say it. There's somebody who is very knowing, who is an experienced healer of sorts and will lead the ayahuasca ceremony. They prepare the brew. So I understand, because you and I spent a lunch together, Ruben, that you actually made ayahuasca brew. You had an experience without going into where you did it or anything. I'm not interested in that, but talk about your involvement start to finish. What was that like?
Well, it was great connecting to that. So I was lucky enough to be able to pick the chacruna leaves directly off the plant and then find the ayahuasca vine in the jungle and then pound the vine and say prayers over the whole process. And then it's a cooking process. So you have to, there's different layers, and then you cook the leaves and the vine in this brew soup, you know, and you have to cook it down over days and days and days. It's a slow cooking process, and you're constantly stirring and you're constantly putting your intention in every time you stir it. And the other people
This is your intention, or is this like a global intention or for the ceremony participants?
It's both. So all of the above. So you put your intention for what you want to get out of it personally. You put the intention of what, you know, other people are going to be drinking this brew, not just you, because it's a big brew. It's a big tub of Aya for our group and for going out for the others. So that's the idea. This is what they do in the jungles too. You know, this is what the idea of intention is such an important part of the ayahuasca process. And you know, this even taking part in the circle, in the medicine circle, you set your intention before you go in. When you're in those states, you're constantly reminding yourself of the intention you set before going in, and you're getting messages usually around that sort of intention. So intention is a big part of the ayahuasca experience, including the making of the medicine and putting the intention of, and we know about cymatics and how that works, and Dr. Emoto and his work, and I'm sure you've discussed that on your show. So we know how intention can affect the vibrational frequency of a molecular structure of something as simple as water. And when we have the plant medicine intention, there's a genetic archetype with that grandmother spirit that's part of the vine, that's part of the chacruna leaves, that's already part of 1,000 years of lineage of indigenous using this to heal. And all of that intention is already built into the DNA and molecular structure of the vine and of the plants themselves. And then now you're adding your intention. The group is adding their intention. The shamans are adding their intention. So a lot of powerful intention goes into making this stuff. And some brews are different than others, maybe not as much intention or whatever. And you can always sort of reset the molecular intention. And this is what you do when you hold the cup and you put your intention into it as you're praying over it before you take the drink. So any sort of negative intention that may have been put into it for whatever reason that you didn't see, you can always restructure the brew right there and redo it just before you drink it. But with that said, we made some powerful medicine. and it's a very humbling experience. It's like right now I'm growing my garden and winter's coming in and it's hard to grow a little bit, but all summer I was eating the salad that came out of the garden. You know, every day I'm having an abundance of salad and oh my God, there's so much salad and there's so much veggies and greens and good stuff and Swiss chard and kale. And when you consume the fruits of your labor in the sense of a food or a drink or any type of something like that, it tastes so much better. And then you want to invite people, come eat, you know, this is good stuff, you know. And then there's an intention that went into the garden, the plants, you know, every day we're watering it. And as you know, my wife and I are watering the garden, and mostly her with the soil stuff. I have a hydroponics machine. I'm a little disconnected because I've got other stuff going on. I'm just like, just put the nutrients in there and it'll do its thing. But no, she's in there sending love to all the plants, watering them daily. And with every water, she's sending powerful intention of this food is going to provide us with nutrients that we need. And that disconnect that has happened through our food supply and through many things in our life, what the ayahuasca ceremony teaches us is how we can incorporate that back into our lives. Yeah. And how intention for self-production, for our own sovereignty, you know, having a garden, or creating whatever we're going to create and put out into the world, to have that intention, to know that it's not only going to feed you, but it's also going to nurture and feed the rest of society and the world. And everything we choose to do in our life should be built. This intention can be built and restructured into how we operate in this world. And
it's, I think, truly grassroots, without a doubt. How long from start to finish did it take to actually create the brew?
About 5 days.
5 days. How many hours every day?
Well, it's constantly boiling. It's boiling. You know, the first day is really the hard work of pounding the vine, getting the leaves. Well, I guess picking, if you had that, it'd be another day of picking, but you can get it started and going, and then you set it up and then you just cook it for, you know, it's a 5 day cook down process. So, and we're going in, so we would mix it, spend about, you know, 20, 30 minutes a day, each of us mixing and putting intention. Some of us would do it more, but it needed to be constantly mixed and cooked. So.
So before I ask the next question, let me ask this. How many times have you drunk? How many times have you ingested medicine?
Well, I've had different types of medicine, but primarily the Aya, it's been, I would say, over 20 times.
Okay, fantastic. So of the 20 times you've done ayahuasca, how was this different? The experience of then taking it in ceremony and experiencing it than what you had had previously, or was there a difference?
Well, there was definitely that deep appreciation of the work, of this type of work. And not only my own intention, but the shamans and the people who do this work and go throughout the world carrying this ancient technology, again, using that word, I think it's a technology, and carrying it through creating a delivery service, in a sense, to people who need it across the world. It's just a very powerful modality that is so needed on the planet at this time. And I think that shamans know this, and that's why they've allowed it to go out. They know this is the time for this work, and that it's a two-way pump, meaning that the people have to be ready to receive it as well. So they're very good. The shamans are very good at reading energy and knowing timing of things. Mm-hmm. So yes, on that sense, just the huge amount of gratitude for the modality itself. And obviously taking that to the next level for being, experiencing the whole journey from the picking of the vine to the intention and the prayer and to the delivery system, to finally ending up in ceremony, a week later, where that medicine is being used for my own healing. Just that whole process is in the appreciation and gratitude for the process.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned the importance of the shamans. It really is everything. I mean, they're the ones who are going to offer spiritual guidance, and they work on a lot of different levels as well during a ceremony. I'll tell you something funny. You were mentioning about what gets put into the cup and holding the cup and having the intention. I did an excursion out of country, and it was 4 back-to-back ceremonies. I was definitely so scared, but I did it, and it was amazing. And by the 4th night, they brought in a Colombian shaman. And Ruben, we met with him in the daytime when he was describing, oh, tonight you're going to have yahe. So I'll tell you right up front, pretty much have the bucket, but try to keep it inside of you if you can. 30 minutes, definitely an hour is even better. So the medicine can take place. And then if you need to purga, go for it, because it's actually things inside of you. And their contention was that the water molecules in the body, speaking of Dr. Emoto, that there are water molecules in the body that hold trauma. Mm-hmm. And that those water molecules would literally release them from the body. Yep. So for anyone listening who hasn't done it, and I know, because I was also scared, like, oh, throwing up, it actually is this relief. You know, something toxic that you've been living with has now exited. Mm-hmm. So all of that to say, it's yahe night, and I was in, oh my goodness, just thinking about it, I was having a panic attack. And everybody was in line waiting to get their cup of brew. I had already expressed how very nervous I was in the daytime to the shaman. And so I went up, I got my cup. Yes, it was disgusting, but drank my water, cleaned my mouth, went back. And all I could think was sitting on my mattress, just hold it in, just hold it in, just hold it in. So here I was, the one person like having a mage panic attack. And so I will say that after an hour, definitely a lot was released from my body in a lot of ways. And what is amazing, because you don't know how these things are going to occur. You literally don't know what the journey is going to be like. When I heard the call for the second cup, I checked inside and I was like, do we go up? And I heard Spirit tell me very definitively, yes, we're getting a second cup.
All right.
So I go up, I'm waiting in line, very short line at this point. And the shaman, Leo, looks at me like, because he knew, like, you were the one with the panic attack.
Yeah.
And he asked me some questions, because he's not going to just hand over brew. Yeah, it's, yeah. Why? What do you want to get out of this? And I looked at him and I said, I have been dealing with fear my whole life and anxiety. And you know what? I'm here because I'm ready to get rid of it. Can we put that into the cup, please? Because I am so done with that experience. And He was fully on board, turned around, got the cup, filled it up, boom, down it went.
Yep.
So the great thing is, I have to say, I would say, I don't know what percentage is gone from my life, but it's massive. What got lifted from me that night, that intention, and I have never had to experience again. But I also, just because it's a fun story, will tell you that as the night went on, and I still La Purgued a lot, and I had divine experiences like beyond that third cup call, I was a three cupper that night. So I thought it was rather hilarious and amazing all at once that the person having the panic attack would be told by spirit over and over, yes, we're going back. Yes, we're not done yet. And to just trust the process, you know, you talk about weaponizing your curiosity. You talked about that in part one of our interview. And there's something to that about, you know, the curious mind, the curious being, allowing energy and experience to lead them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So have you had anything similar that was a big surprise to you?
Well, since we're on the subject of curiosity, one of the things that I've sort of some recent downloads around that is that if we all remain curious and open-minded, and in that exploratory mindset, without judgment, but simply trying to understand. And you may not figure it out, but if you stay in that state of trying to understand the other, the other can be anything, the plant, the bug, the animal, the other person, the ET, the other religion, whatever it is, as long as you're trying to understand, and again, and this gets into empathy and empathizing with people and the things and everything in all of life. But it, but really what empathy is what is empathy? Empathy is just you're trying to understand. You may not understand. That's okay. It's the act of trying to understand the other. That's empathy. That's what it is. Not sympathy, because when you sympathize with someone, you're actually falling to their level and you're agreeing with them on whatever level they're at, not allowing any type of out from where they're at. So you get stuck in a rut. That's what sympathy is. Empathy is the curiosity of you trying to understand, still allows the other person, if they're in a rut or whatever, to see that you're trying to peer into their world, and then that your world is different than their world. So that gives them a shining light to follow if they choose to go there. So you're always giving them an out, so to say, by simply trying to understand. And it's up to you whether, well, it's not up to you, whether you get it or not. In a sense, it's up to you, but it's not necessary. And this is one of the biggest downloads I got, is you don't have to figure it out in order for the mechanism of curiosity to work. Does that make sense?
It really makes sense. And I'm wondering, post that download, how did that impact your marriage? Were you married at the time? And how did you come back?
Yeah, this is all pretty recently. This is like the past couple months. Like, I've always been curious and I've always wanted, you know, that's just been who I am. But to understand the mechanism of curiosity and how it works and being able to explain it in this way was really just the past couple of months. And it was like a big aha moment. And this is part of why on my show, I offer the buffet I offer. I actually don't understand all of the channelers that I put on. I understand them to a certain extent, And I resonate with others, like, as you know, Lisa, who I've had on the show many times, because I really resonate with them. But others, some of it just goes over my head and I'm just, what are they saying? I'm trying to understand. And it was a channeler recently that I interviewed that I was like, I just don't get it. But you know, that's okay. It's okay. And that's what the download was. You don't have to get it. Just by the curiosity, people will watch the show and see my curiosity, because it's genuine. My curiosity is genuine. I'm trying to understand some of these teachings and some of these realities and some of these, how this works. I don't get it at all. But that act of trying it's opening the door, and it gives other people, they'll be able to see the episode as this guy's trying to understand it. And if anything, if I don't get any of it either, at least what I do get is the act of trying to understand another is how we break down all the walls, all the barriers, all the wars. We can have peace on the planet if we all just simply try to understand another. We don't have to understand one another. We just have to try and make the effort.
Interesting. So the difference between sympathy and empathy. Yeah, understood. And what else in your buffet of outside of your show, the buffet of what you've done? I'm assuming San Pedro, mushrooms.
Yeah, all of it.
Have you done the 20-minute DMT?
I've attempted it. It didn't work for me.
Huh.
Smoke and I don't get along very well. So I've never been high off of smoking marijuana or smoking anything in that sense. And I've attempted to try the smoke, administer DMT straight in that sense of a few times actually. And it shaman cut me off because after about five doses and five, you know, he was like, yeah, this is not working. I'm cutting you off. So I was like, okay, that's understandable.
Oh, that's bully for you. You really did try.
It's not that maybe I'm superhuman or something. I think there's just my body and smoke don't get along in a sense. So my body rejects any type of smoke. Really, if I try to inhale and a cigarette or even any kind of tobacco or even marijuana, I'll go into a coughing fit for about an hour, and it's very unpleasant. Vapes, I can take them without the cough, but I'm not feeling any of the effects of it. So my lungs, I think it's just me and my lungs don't say, nope, not there. We're not doing that.
You mentioned Lisa on the part one of this interview, as well as here, Lisa Royal Holt. And so she does exquisite work. Mm-hmm. And I know she's been on your show a couple of times. She's soon to come up on season three. So you meet her. And I want to be really clear with the audience with this question. The question is, what is your relationship with her? But Ruben is married, so we're not going there. Yeah. And Lisa's got an amazing husband, Ron Holt, who's extremely gifted in his own right.
He'll also be in season three.
Who will also, about quantum navigation, right? Which is, I've had an experience of, holy moly. And I want to know, though, because that's kind of cool when somebody comes on your show and you interview them, and it could just be one thing like a meet and greet and thank you very much. But instead, it seems that something else has happened. So talk a little bit about your relationship with Lisa.
Well, when I first started the series, I began with the people I knew. Wendy, I reached out to Gerald, who was busy at the time. And we ended up getting his interview for season two. But Nora, Rob Gothier had come recommended. So all of these, I'd sort of like one step led to another. And I would talk to people or interview people, and then they would give me recommendations. And I was just kind of going by that, synchronicities, or I'd check somebody out and, oh, this person seems, they'd show up on my YouTube feed or whatever. And this person seems, I resonate with the message enough to pursue that and try to get them on the show. And that's sort of just the breadcrumbs, we keep saying, that I've been following during this whole process. So, I had known Lee prior to even starting the show, and it just seemed like it fit. I had known Adam Apollo also before the show, and he just seemed like a fit for the show. So some people I'd already known, some people were new, some people were recommendations. And I just, Lisa was a well-known channeler, one of the more well-known ones, especially when it came to the ET storyline. So many people had recommended, oh, you should check out Lisa, you should check out Lisa. So eventually I reached out to her and I said, hey, Lisa, I've got the show I'm doing. And she, in a sense, like with you, a little bit of reluctancy, had to do her own homework and figure out, and then it felt good. And then I was able to go to her house in Phoenix and interview her. And it turned out during the interview, we had a lot of synchronicities as far as the ties and relationships to Japan. That was actually, that interview was just about 2 weeks before I actually met my wife. So it's funny because right after that, literally a week after that interview, I went to Japan for work 4 years ago almost. Almost four years ago now. And then met my wife in Japan. And then we, I guess you could say dated for a year or so, and then decided to get married. And now we've been married for 3 years. So the synchronicity is because of Japan and Lisa's work with the Japanese people. And I went to a couple of contact retreats out in Japan. And just, there's a lot of overlap with that and our journey in that sense. And we really have a synchronicity and connection to the Japanese culture.
You're mentioning a lot of the people you've had on the show, and I don't know how much is in the can for season three, or if you're quite in process with that. What haven't you done yet that you would really like to see happen on Interview with Extra Dimensional?
Well, I always joke that the last episode, or maybe the first episode of whatever, you know, season 20 or wherever we're at that point, is will be an interview on a ship with an ET in an actual physical ET and whatever camera gear we have at that time to be able to capture that moment. I joke that that's what, you know, it's going to get there. We're going to get to that spot where I'm actually finally interviewing an actual physical being. So that gives you an idea of what I have in mind for where we're headed with this. But
any guests you haven't had on that you'd really like love bucket list to interview?
I think they're all slated for season three. So
cool. Stay tuned.
I'm in talks with Esther, Esther Hicks and Abraham. So that would probably be like one of the big, you know, the big names that I think would be cool to have of that level. You know, obviously we had Daryl on the show already. So we'll see where things go. But if not, I think after season three, there's some other projects that I wanted to focus on. So I'm probably going to put a little pause on things. Just to get these other projects in the can, and then maybe something I can pick up later. But we'll see where the popularity of the show goes. We'll see if Gaia decides to take, whether they decide to take a season three or not. I've committed myself to finish a season three in either self-distribute or there seems to be a lot of interest from other distributors as well. So we'll see how that all plays out. But for sure, there will be a season three.
So you mentioned Japan. Mm-hmm. I know you've had a lot of career in Japan in the past. Mm-hmm. Your wife is from Japan.
Yes.
How, talk about Japan in your life. What does that country mean? How did you learn the language? Not easy to learn.
Well, I had, since a kid, I had this fascination with Japan through, you know, the Asian culture.
Past life.
Probably past life, of course. Yeah. Just Asian culture in general fascinated me. Mm. Ninjas and samurais. And and then I got into the anime and the manga with, you know, Japanese comics, which then really gave me a deeper look into that society through their lens, because they have these stories that they create in comics. But a lot of cultural influences are portrayed in these comics. You know, just like Americans have Marvel comics and we have an American culture through Captain America, you know, and Spider-Man and all of these things, you can really get an idea of what the American psyche is just by looking at our comics and at our storytelling. So I was looking through that lens of storytelling through the Japanese comic book world and anime. And I was just fascinated with the culture, just growing up through junior high and into high school and video games. At the time, most of the predominant main video games, successful ones, were coming from Japan. You know, we had the Nintendo and the Genesis and the Sega Genesis and then the PlayStation and all of our, you know, Final Fantasy and all the most cutting edge games were coming out of Japan. So that really sparked my interest. And I was like, I got to get there. There's something about this culture that I need to experience. And I need to, it's a part of me already, but I need to go deeper. So, you know, at the age of 19, it was several years in the making. It wasn't just on a whim, but I had saved up some money and bought a plane ticket and decided to go to Japan. And when I got there, I fell in love immediately with all aspects of it and ended up staying. And I lived there for five years with a year or almost 2 years back and forth to Hong Kong. Then eventually moving back to the States in 1999.
And you did a ton of commercials while you were there.
Yeah, I did a ton.
You were like this adorable, Prince Charming, blonde haired white boy.
Yeah, yeah.
That's... Tons of Japanese commercials.
Yeah, if I had done that body of work of commercials in America, I'd be a very well off rich guy right now. But in Japan, they don't have residuals. The market is quite a bit smaller than the US market. So I got paid usually a couple hundred bucks per commercial but it was fun. And that's how I paid my bills while living there. While I was studying martial arts and training, the bills got paid through that type of work, through doing commercials and modeling.
Amazing. Okay. So what do you do today? What do you do today, Ruben, besides medicine?
Well, I don't do medicine every day.
What do you do on a daily basis that keeps you really grounded? Do you have a practice? Do you have a ritual that you engage in?
I practice the Wim Hof method, which is a set of breath work in exercises. And I ended up getting away from that a little bit over the summer because I was doing a lot of meditating in the garden. In the backyard, laying down concrete blocks, building up I put up a greenhouse, and just doing those sort of that sort of yard work in a sense was very meditative. And I realized that because I didn't have enough time in the day to do my editing and my interviews and research, and do Wim Hof and do the garden, so I kind of exchanged the Wim Hof work with the gardening work, and it worked out because there was I got a lot out of that. There was a lot of meditation going on as I was working with those elements, with the stone elements for laying the brickwork and with the wood elements for building the grow boxes, and then the soil elements for laying down mixing the soil and getting it ready to then seed the seeds. And it is that whole process. It's everybody should be gardening. Like it's a very powerful meditative process when you go through the whole process, and then you actually finally get to eat your vegetables that you've grown. So that was summer. Now I'm back into the Wim Hof method again.
Are you referring to rhythmic breathing when you talk about Wim Hof?
Yeah, it's breathing. His method is kind of, I haven't studied officially Kundalini, but I've talked to a lot of Kundalini practitioners, and I've guided them through some Wim Hof methods sessions. And they say the sensations that are created through this breath work are very similar to Kundalini yoga work. So what we're doing is it's big, deep breaths in, and nice relaxed out. Then we do a set of those, about 20 to 30. And then we hold the breath on the exhale. And then we take a deep breath in. And then we do another round, and we keep going. And the longer we go for longer periods of holding, and then bigger deep breaths in, and then the sensations. And I have a YouTube video. I put out a little mini video called the Alchemy of Wim Hof. Which I shot just locally here in Big Bear, as I was sort of, that was my beginnings of learning that process. And and some of the downloads that I got during that process. And I continue to get downloads because what we're doing is, I believe, with every session of Wim Hof or any type of Qigong or any type of breathing or meditation, is we're literally creating portals to other dimensions that we can then go through and access information. And this is why in the meditative state, when we quiet our minds and when we focus on the breath, we are going into that space where talk about gatekeepers of the media and these kinds of things. We are our own gatekeepers to the other sides, the veils. Mm-hmm. And when we take ingest the plant medicine, or we create these modalities to have communication to the other side, then the information becomes more free flowing. And the more we do that, the more we create those portals, the more information can flow in from these higher dimensions. Mm.
So Ruben, this is Dare to Dream. What mm-hmm. are you next Dare to Dream? What are your future dreams or goals?
Well, I kind of already said it with doing that interview on the spaceship, but let me go big picture.
Okay.
So as we all know, we're going through a major transformation on the planet right now. It seems hectic and chaotic and crazy, and it is. You know, there's a lot going on with pandemics and political chaos and monetary chaos with different things. But what I see happening is the shift in consciousness, as far as everyone fully coming to the realization that we are individually sovereign beings with immense power to create whatever we want to create. Mm-hmm. To wake up to that. And we can talk about it and we can remind people that we're all interconnected and that we're all one, we all create our own reality. These are buzzwords we've heard for decades. But to truly understand that, we have to go, in a sense, we don't all have to, but we are going through what we're going through to help us awaken to that fact. And once the majority of us awaken to that fact, that we can create whatever reality we choose, I think, I have faith in humanity. There's a lot of good people on this planet with good intentions. And when we focus those intentions and that goodness, and we can harmonize and become a coherent force, which we're doing right now, we're figuring it out. This is new energy, this is new technologies, new modalities that we're playing with. As we continue to play and continue to sync up and figure it out, what I see happening in the next 10, 20, 30 years is a place unrecognizable than where we are now. We can't even fathom, we can't even use our imagination. And I'm one who uses my imagination to create some big things. We can't even imagine what that's going to look like because it's never been done before on this planet. And I know it's very epic, something that I'm talking about here. This is like the most epic of all epicness. And it is for the human race. This is the biggest thing to ever happen in our DNA, in our lifetimes, in all lifetimes, in history, and in the universe. And this is why we have so much assistance right now from behind the veil, from our 18 brothers and sisters, from grandmother, mama, Pachamama. This is why all of this assistance is here right now to help us come to this realization. Because they know that once we are fully empowered, we will become a very powerful force in the cosmology of the universe to then go and assist and help other civilizations awaken in their own unique ways.
Well, this has been an amazing couple of hours for me to hang out with you, Ruben. Thank you so much. And for people who want to know more, RubenLangdon.com, best place.
That's it, RubenLangdon.com. And my show, Interview with Ed, which is also one word, interviewwithed.org. And you can go to Gaia to see it, but all that information is there. And also the citizenhearing.org is also another project that more people will be seeing very soon.
I end today's show with this quote from Gary Thorpe. Try to be a good audience for whatever kind of experience reveals itself to you. Subscribe to Dare to Dream. It's your number one weekly transformation conversation. My guest next week is Dr. Gabriel Cousins. He's an internationally celebrated spiritual master, a rabbi, and also founder of the Modern Essene Order of Light. He already teaches in 40 countries. He's got an enormous amount of information to share with us, and I'm ready to deep dive with him. Thanks for joining us today. And remember, do not just dare to dream. Dare to turn all your dreams into your reality. And maybe one day you will also be with us on that spaceship.
To contact the award-winning syndicated Dare to Dream radio show, go to debbiedashinger.com. Keep your excellent feedback and comments coming. Your host, Debbie Dashinger, is an expert at goal achievement, a media personality, an international best-selling author, and a keynote speaker. Debbie leads high-quality teleseminars on how to achieve goals, how to be a self-published best-selling author, and how to get booked on radio. All classes are at debbiedashinger.com. Debbie's best-selling books are Dare to Dream, This Life Counts, sold on Amazon, and her second book, Wisdom to Success, The Secrets to Accomplish All Your Dreams, sold online at all bookstores. Tune in again to hear the next inspiring interview guest who has turned their vision into a successful reality. Want more support in making your dreams come true? Go to debbiedashinger.com. That's www.debbiedashinger.com. You'll see videos, MP3s, archived interviews, and amazing products sharing the secret steps to making your dreams come true. Remember to dream big with every expectation that your dream will become real. Dreams are free, so free your dreams. What do you dare to dream? Standing